This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Middle East activist Phyllis Bennis.
She's just back from Egypt and the West Bank. We talked to her about the indictments of Mubarak, his sons, the former head of the secret police, and the upcoming elections in Egypt, and also the unfolding events regarding a possible Palestinian state in the Mideast.
We'll discuss the continued people's resistance in the state of Wisconsin.
You may not have read about it, but 100,000 people were in Milwaukee protesting.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Last week, the Supreme Court gave police even more discretion to break into homes or apartments in search of illicit drugs when they think the evidence might be destroyed. In an 8-1 decision, with Justice Ginsburg dissenting, the justices wrote that officers who smell marijuana and loudly knock on the door can break in if they hear sounds that suggest the residents are rushing to hide the drugs. Justice Ginsburg wrote that the ruling in a Kentucky case gave the police, quote, a way routinely to dishonor the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement in drug cases. In lieu of presenting their evidence to a neutral magistrate, police officers may now knock, listen, then break the door down, never mind that they had ample time to obtain a warrant. She said that the Fourth Amendment's core requirement is that officers have probable cause and a search warrant before they break into a house. At question, really, is how secure are our homes, given that this decision may encourage law enforcement officials to undertake what are called knock-and-talk raids. It's surprising that 8 of the 9 justices supported this decision. Because the police already have several exceptions to the requirement that search warrants be obtained. So-called exigent circumstances are when police believe an emergency requires bypassing the warrant, such as if they hear screams coming from a house, or if they see a fleeing individual entering a residence. In this Kentucky case, police witnessed a drug deal in a parking lot, then ran into an apartment complex looking for a suspect who had sold cocaine to an informant. The smell of burning marijuana led them to the wrong apartment. After knocking and announcing themselves, they heard sounds that they said made them fear the evidence was being destroyed. They kicked the door in, found marijuana and cocaine, but not the original suspect they were trailing. The Kentucky Supreme Court suppressed the evidence, saying any risk of drugs being destroyed was the result of the decision by police to knock and announce themselves rather than to obtain a warrant. So the U.S. Supreme Court reversed that decision last week, saying the police acted lawfully, and that was all that mattered. In what seems really a ludicrous assertion, Justice Alito said that the defendant had choices in the case. He could have chosen not to respond to the knocking in any fashion, or he could have come to the door and declined to let the officers enter without a warrant. And we know what would have happened in either of those scenarios. All the court decided, Alito wrote, was when evidence must be suppressed because police had created the exigency. Lower courts had approached that question in 5 ways. The standard announced Monday, Alito wrote, had the virtue of simplicity. And in another update, Michael, last week federal prosecutors tried to force James Risen, as you know, a New York Times reporter, to testify at a criminal trial about who leaked information to him about the CIA's effort to sabotage the Iranian nuclear program at the end of the Clinton administration.
Yeah, they argue that they should treat him, a reporter for the New York Times, like any other citizen, and therefore he has to testify.
Exactly. And I think this is part of a broader Obama administration crackdown on officials accused of disclosing restricted information to journalists.
Well, there's been more crackdowns on not just journalists, but whistleblowers across the board under Obama than ever before.
That's true. During his office, both civilian and military prosecutors have charged 5 individuals in cases involving leaked information, more than all the previous presidents combined. And in a few weeks, as you know, former NSA official Thomas Drake goes on trial on charges that he provided classified information to the Baltimore Sun about agency mismanagement and cost overruns. One thing I think is interesting in the Risen case, who, by the way, has said he's going to fight this subpoena, citing his need to protect sources and fight for freedom of the press, is that if the court doesn't grant his motion to quash the subpoena, he risks, as you know, being held in contempt. Prosecutors are asserting that Jeffrey Sterling gave him classified information that served as the basis for a chapter in his 2000 book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. The material in that chapter hadn't actually appeared in the Times, and so Justice Department wants Risen to testify about what Sterling told him and when he provided that information. I think this issue goes to an overclassification problem that we have in this country. By some estimates, over 1 billion classified documents exist, and that number's growing. And as more information is made secret, in all honesty, I think it diminishes the credibility about the government's judgment about what should and should not be made secret.
Well, overclassification is precisely what it is. It's not something new. At the Len Weinglass Memorial, one of the attorney friends of Len was telling a story about how he was trying a case and they had classified something as top secret. So they called Howard Zinn up to the stand. Turns out that what they classified as top secret was Howard Zinn's entire book.
Michael, last week, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. What documents are they trying to get now?
Well, we at the center want to find out what the United States did and knew about the Israeli attack on the flotilla that was attempting to break the illegal siege of Gaza a year ago. And in the course of that, of course, you know, 9 people were killed, including an American citizen, a young man, 18 years old, and he was shot, beaten, laying on the deck of the ship, and then shot in the face and executed.
And he was shot as he was filming the 4 a.m. raid.
Exactly.
A point-blank range. That's just an atrocity. Listeners can actually read the complaint, Michael. It's on the center's website at ccrjustice.org. And I think if you use the search function, you can find it.
Furkan Duan, the young man that was assassinated, I think would be the right word, is being represented by his father, Professor Ahmet Duan. He's the client of the center, and he has been stonewalled up till now on trying to find out what role the United States government played in this. It's another case of a cover-up. We follow up with our interview with Abdin Jabara on the topic of the Egyptian Revolution and its aftermath after the overthrow of Mubarak. Egypt's tourism has declined, its crime rate has risen, labor strikes continue. Mubarak is under indictment for his role in the murder of 800 protesters during those glorious 18 days in January that led to his overthrow. His 2 sons are under indictment. Mubarak is under another indictment for taking a bribe which amounted to a 16,000 square foot mansion. And the movement in Egypt continues to unfold. We're joined by writer and Mideast activist Phyllis Bennis. She currently directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis has recently returned from Egypt, and she joins us today for an update and analysis.
Welcome, Phyllis, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Now, we understand you've just returned from Egypt. Why were you there?
I actually was traveling in the hope of going to Gaza. I was there with Richard Falk, a noted international law scholar who is currently the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. He's been prohibited from entering, from doing his mandated position, actually, by the Israelis. When he tried to enter the West Bank, he was arrested at Tel Aviv Airport, thrown into a rather dirty jail cell, and deported the next day. The Israelis announced they would not recognize his mandate. They would not allow him to enter. Of course, you have to enter Israel in order to get into the West Bank by air, and that he would be prohibited from carrying out that mandate. Our plan was to go to Gaza instead via the Rafah crossing, the crossing controlled by Egypt. At the last minute, Richard was told that by the UN security team that they did not believe it was safe for him to go because of the security conditions in Gaza. I was not so prohibited, but as it turned out, I was not able to go. I spent a day at the Gaza border trying to get in unsuccessfully, which was an interesting experience, sort of seeing firsthand the kind of political struggle, power struggle that's currently underway in Egypt in the context of the Arab Spring, the overthrow of Mubarak, and the extraordinary excitement of the Tahrir Square uprising. So the trip merged sort of my work on Israel-Palestine issues and my broader work on the region and U.S. policy towards the Arab Spring.
Yeah, well, they truly are interconnected, Israel being the number one recipient of American aid and Egypt being the number two. Phyllis, being over there, you know, it's frustrating for us because we really can't follow so closely what we'd like to follow because of the difficulty with the news. But being over there and seeing how the Arab Spring is continually unfolding, what's your take on the latest news that there's supposed to be a big demonstration that's coming Friday, that Mubarak has been indicted, his two sons also? What's your take on the movement as it's continuing there?
Well, it's an extraordinary time. I think there are, and this is what we heard from so many different people in Cairo, there are no guarantees. There's no guarantees that the incredible accomplishments of the Arab Spring will lead to the kind of new democratic opening in Egyptian society, let alone in the Egyptian economy, that people are working for. There's no guarantees. But there's an enormous sense of excitement at what has been accomplished so far. And even those who were on the pessimistic side, those who think it's going to get very bad again and could, with, you know, whether coming from the military, from elements of the former regime, et cetera, everybody agrees it's not ever going to go back to what it was, that the wall of fear that made possible the kind of Mubarak dictatorship that lasted for so long, that led to, you know, the collaboration between Egypt and Israel under U.S. auspices in repressing Palestinians, imposing the siege of Gaza, that that's no longer going to be possible. The widespread use of arbitrary arrest and torture. Torture was far more prevalent and routine in Egypt than I had realized. And I've studied the region for years, and I didn't know how ordinary it was, how everybody who was arrested expected at least to be roughed up and beaten, if not tortured severely. Everybody agrees it will never go back to that. Having said that, the question of what will come next remains a big challenge. There's a great deal of engagement in Egypt right now. People are moving on this question of what comes next. And most people we talked to were completely engaged in meetings. Well, I can't see you at that time. I've got a meeting. Every sector of society, women's organizations, privacy rights groups, trade unions, the labor movement, everybody is engaged in discussions trying to figure out how to keep the level of mobilization. The fact that there are still protests going on, some are rather celebratory, some are protesting acts of the military government. There are incredible changes underway. The recent incidents that we saw of a very sectarian nature, clashes between Copts and some extremist versions of Islam, the Salafis, who are a very small element within Egyptian society but have a presence. There's a lot of fear that that is less a reflection of a kind of indigenous sectarianism among Egyptians, rather that it's actually more a reflection of the efforts of the former regime to come to power in a different way. There's a lot of fear, but also a sense of excitement about the ability of people to fight back and new levels of unity across sectarian lines, across generational lines, across class, that are increasingly important, I think, inside Egypt. The question of the role of the U.S. remains very key. We saw it, for example, I mentioned earlier my effort to get into Gaza on this trip, which I ultimately was not able to do. And from what I could tell, what was really going on, it had little to do with me going in, than it did with an ongoing power struggle between the existing power at the, in this case, the Gaza crossing, the Rafah crossing between Egypt and Gaza, which is controlled on the ground by military intelligence, the same military intelligence that had been there during the Mubarak years, between them and the foreign ministry, which of course now reflects the interests of the new civilian government that has come to power only since the overthrow of Mubarak and since the Arab Spring. And what we saw was that the new foreign minister, who was appointed just a couple of months ago, a noted international law scholar in his own right, Nabil El Arabi, I met with him along with Richard Falk, and he told us very clearly what he has said publicly, that he believes, and he thinks this is what is wanted by the majority of people in Egypt, for the siege of Gaza to end. He said the siege of Gaza is a war crime. It may be a crime against humanity. But then, and he said, we want to not only open the crossing, allow people to cross in both directions freely, but we want to rebuild the structures at the crossing so that it's accessible for building supplies, for cement, for flour, for everything that people need. He said the siege of Gaza must end. But, he said, we have to keep in mind that there are security considerations underway, so we will not be the only decision makers. To me, what he was implying was that the military will still play a role. The military itself has multiple interests. On the one hand, you have people in the military saying, my God, for the first time, we are supported by the population rather than being seen as a repressive agency. We want to maintain that. We want to help people through this period. We want to be popular. We don't want to be facing what we did, the kind of hatred that we did earlier on. On the other hand, there are forces in the military who are saying, well, let's keep in mind that the United States still pays us, the military, $1.3 billion a year. That money doesn't go to the government, it goes to the military. And in the context of that aid, if anybody in the leadership of the military thinks that the U.S. is perhaps going to withdraw that funding if the Egyptians do something the U.S. doesn't like, like perhaps opening the Gaza border, we may see a growing conflict between the interests of the military and the interests of the foreign ministry. Now, of course, there's an even more interesting wrinkle. The role of foreign minister is now up for grabs again because Nabil El Arabi has just been appointed the new Secretary General of the Arab League, which raises very interesting possibilities for the Arab League, but potentially some new challenges for Egypt. So there's a lot of changes underway in the region.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis has just returned from the Middle East. Phyllis, can you talk a bit about the media coverage there and how, if it has changed at all in the last couple of months?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The media there is overwhelmingly in Arabic. There's very little English-language media that's that different than what we see here. Some of the English-language websites of the Egyptian media, Al Ahram, for instance, which is the sort of flagship daily newspaper in Egypt, long a state-run newspaper, now reflects very much the interests and approach of the new government. So that's been a huge change. It was historically the voice of the Mubarak government, although it traditionally had a fairly wide range of, with a rather open policy editorially, with extraordinarily broad range of columnists who are influential and played a very interesting and key role historically in Egypt. The media was not as suppressed as in some other countries. That has now broadened out. There's much greater reliance, of course, as is true everywhere, on new media, on online sources. Facebook and that sort of thing play a role. Although I think we, to our peril, I think it's rather facile when people here say, oh, this was a Facebook revolution. It was made possible by Facebook.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was going to be my next question, right? Because that, I truly agree with you. There were underlying class forces that were really the power in the political revolution there. But Phyllis, tell me about the elections that are coming up. I know that the left wants to forestall them to give themselves more time to organize, that if they were held soon, it would probably be a bad thing for progressive forces in Egypt. What was your take on that?
Well, the elections were difficult. I don't think there was a unified left position and that the other side was the right. It wasn't as clear-cut as that. There was a sense that if elections are held soon, that the existing parties, meaning predominantly the old ruling party of Mubarak, the NDP, the National Democratic Party, along with the Muslim Brotherhood, who, while they had been suppressed in the early years quite brutally, in the last 5 years or so, had been allowed to emerge and to actually run candidates for the parliament. that the fear was that those existing parties would trounce everybody else because there had never been an open enough political system to allow the formation of other parties, so that there was a fear that they would, you know, simply win out. Other people felt that the urgency of consolidating the democratic gains of the overthrow of Mubarak was more important, and that other forces would be able to gain a foothold. It would be difficult. And, of course, in the election, it was about three quarters of the voters supported quick elections, which are due to be held now next month. And I think it's going to be a huge challenge for progressive forces, for the trade union movement, for the youth movements, for the democracy movements, all of them. It's going to be a huge challenge. Again, there's no guarantees. It may be, although people for months have been saying that in free and fair elections, the Muslim Brotherhood would probably end up with somewhere between 22% and 28% of the vote, something like that, about a quarter of the vote. It could be distorted if other parties are not able to really manage to put together an electoral campaign soon enough. But I think that this was one of those, there's a challenge either way. If the other side had prevailed and the decision was made to put off the elections for a year or so, there was certainly a potential problem that the current government would lose its legitimacy to rule. It, after all, was appointed. This is not an elected government. It was appointed by the military, something that's inherently, you know, anytime you have a progressive revolutionary process underway that's being guaranteed by the old military, you're kind of in trouble.
Yeah, I'll say.
So that would have been a problem as well.
What kind of demands are the left making? I know one of them was to get these prosecutions going against Mubarak and the head of the secret police, Mubarak's two sons, for murder, for stealing, for graft. But what other kind of demands are out there, particularly in view of the terrible poverty that exists in Egypt?
The accountability question certainly has been one of the primary issues for the popular movements, the demand that Mubarak be held accountable, his whole family, his wife, his sons. That is now underway, as we've seen, and I think there's a great deal of excitement about that. The prospect of, I heard the other day one Egyptian commentator sort of exulting that he just figured out that one of Mubarak's sons is actually in the same jail cell that he spent many months in. So he was quite pleased to hear that. So the accountability thing, I think, is well underway. There's always going to be a challenge of how far down the hierarchy do you go. But by starting at the top, they've improved on that far better than many other countries in a similar situation. The broader demands have to do with economic demands. Certainly the trade unions, who played a very important role in this revolutionary process, with the understanding that this has not yet been an economic revolution. We do not yet see the overturning of neoliberal economic policies in Egypt, and I don't think that we will for quite some time. This was a political revolution, and I think right now there's a great deal of concentration on protecting the gains of that process. One of the issues was around accountability of the police, changing some of the structures of the police, as well as eliminating the worst violators of human rights in the past, the various parts of the security police agencies.
Thank you, Phyllis. Talk to us about your perceptions of both Obama's speech and Netanyahu. And you think that the peace process, in quote, is still as much of a fraud as it has been for the last period? Or do you think there's actually some progress going on?
I think there is no progress underway. I think that the Obama speech, which, I mean, it's rather astonishing on a certain level that it's gotten the kind of condemnation from Israel and from supporters of Israel that it has, because there was, as many have acknowledged, there was nothing new in it. This nonsense about the 67 borders somehow being a whole new demand from the U.S. is nonsense on a couple of levels. One, it's certainly not the first time it's ever been raised. It's been the historic basis of the U.S. claims of what a peace process and a two-state solution would look like. What they like to call is the 67 border with land swaps.
Yeah.
Now, all of this, of course, this process has been underway now for 20 years, we're talking about, since the Madrid Conference of 1990.
We're young.
And always, everything about it now is coded. So the code for land swaps means Israel gets to keep at least the three major settlement blocks as a starting point. So the notion that somehow this is, and we're talking here 40% of the land of the West Bank. Now, will that mean that some of these little settlements in the far eastern part of the West Bank will be dismantled? Yeah, probably at some point, and that's just absolutely irrelevant. Those are not the point. The point is the massive land theft that go into these city-sized settlements. Ma'ale Adumim, for instance, outside of Jerusalem, it's a city of almost 40,000 people. It has two colleges, it has high schools, it has a public swimming pool, it has shopping centers, it has an industrial zone, which of course drains its industrial waste down the hill into the Palestinian villages who no longer have access to their own water for that reason. You know, this is what we're talking about. And the proposal from President Obama was to give Israel the right to that land as a starting point. So on a number of levels, that was sort of nonsense. The challenge that President Obama faced more broadly in the region was to position the U.S. as a friend of these new democratic movements, a friend of the poor people rather than the dictators, as he said. It was in very soaring rhetoric. We stand with the impoverished fruit seller in the streets of Tunisia rather than with the dictator. I mean, it sounds fabulous. Mm. But his real challenge was, how do we position ourselves to be a friend of democracy while maintaining our strategic alliances with the existing dictators in the region?
Yeah, that was well said, Phyllis, precisely. And you think that's seen through, particularly by people in Egypt?
Oh, I think so. I think that there was far less illusion about this speech than there was about the Cairo speech of 2 years ago, when there was still enormous hope for President Obama. So many people we met, I've got to tell you, Mike, in Cairo told us, you know, we are completely disappointed in what Obama has done in his policies. We still kind of hope. I mean, there is this edge of what Obama means. In the airport, for instance, when you come into Cairo, in the baggage terminal, there's these huge posters about the Arab Spring and Tahrir Square, and one of them has a quote from President Obama, which I've got to confess, I never saw it. I'm not even sure it's true. People in Egypt want to think that it's true, with Obama saying something like, "We want to give our children Egypt," something like that. It was extraordinary.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
People talked about how Obama's slogan, "Yes, we can," which, of course, was originally the slogan of the United Farm Workers Union and Cesar Chavez in Spanish, but they've taken it up in Arabic as one of the key chants of the revolution of Tahrir Square. So there's an incredible irony that people throughout Egypt, and I think in other parts of the region as well, are enormously disappointed in President Obama's policies, have no illusions that those policies are likely to get any better anytime soon, but at the same time have not entirely given up hope that President Obama, the man, somehow represents something different from what the history of U.S. imperial intervention in that region has been in the past.
Phyllis Bennis, we truly appreciate your being on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to inviting you back. Thank you, Phyllis.
Thank you, Phyllis.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Protests continue in Wisconsin against the union busting bill signed by Governor Scott Walker last March. We're joined today by retired Professor Paul Buell to discuss more about the continued fight in that state. Paul Buell was a senior lecturer at Brown University. He's written over 30 books about American radicalism.
Paul, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Tell us what's going on there. What's the arc of the struggle and what's been your role?
Oh, the arc of the struggle really begins in February when the new governor, Republican governor, barely elected with a low vote and in the midst of considerable disillusionment with the Democratic Party since the 08 election. The new governor, who ran on a sort of mediocre basis, announced to everyone's surprise drastic changes in the state under a so-called budget repair bill in which virtually all bargaining rights of public unions would be rescinded, in which basic environmental laws would be repealed, and communities that came up with a minus budget would fall under the control of political appointees who could replace them by fiat from above, among other issues. So as this was being attempted to pass in the state Senate, 14 Senate Democrats fled the state across the line, purportedly into Illinois, and remained sequestered for a couple of weeks, while in Madison itself, the capital of Wisconsin, crowds ranging from 1,000 to 100,000 circled the Capitol on an almost daily basis and slept in in the Capitol Rotunda on a daily and nightly basis for 2 to 3 weeks, something, events that had never been seen before, and that brought labor solidarity from various unions from across the country, but also brought all kinds of celebrities, including Tom Morello, to Madison to give speeches or to sing, and in general created a sense that the attempt to roll back the New Deal and 1940s to 50s benefits that had been created in the social state and to replace it with a stark right-wing agenda was now facing a remarkable fight back, which might have implications far from Wisconsin.
We followed it closely here from New York. We saw 2,000 tractors coming through a snowstorm and descending on the state capitol. It was amazing. But let me ask you this, because this is what's dismaying to me. What concerns me is that it seems that all this energy and creativity and militancy has been kind of channeled away into recalling 8 Republican senators next fall.
And some Democrats as well, I think, right, Paul?
That's correct. Among the Democrats who left the state there's for those weeks, there's an attempt to get rid of them. Well, you ask a very important and difficult question. The ability of the movement in those beginning weeks and in the bitterest cold weather to suggest that the struggle was over the presence of teachers and social workers and so forth rather than a matter of wages or benefits was had very great success. But
explain that a little bit. I sort of understood it, but just unpack that a little bit. That's an interesting sentence.
Well, as in other states and as in Congress, the Republicans insisted that since the pay and benefits of public workers were greater than those in the private sector, which makes a little sense because the factories have fled and private sector's workers are doing so much worse, that those state workers now appeared greedy and needed to be cut back, and that the very idea of public union was illogical because they were a powerful voting bloc, et cetera, et cetera. The response of public workers, led by teachers and social workers, and then followed in solidarity actions by every kind of union, was to say, no, if belt tightening is necessary, we expect everyone to do it, but don't take away our bargaining rights and the basis for our dignified labor, and don't present these demands to lay people off when huge tax benefits are being delivered to corporations and public resources are being sold off with no-bid contracts to some of the same powerful forces in Wisconsin is not a mystery that the Koch brothers from Kansas were the major backers of Scott Walker's campaign and set up an office only a block from the Capitol and are very likely the architects of the ideas and the plans.
Paul, I wanted to ask about the injunction that is preventing the bill that Governor Walker signed on March 11th from becoming law. And I understand the bill is now before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Can you explain what's happening?
I'm not sure anyone can explain the legal complications of what's happening. We ponder this day by day. As best as can be understood, a local justice, Marion Sumi, declared that these provisions could not override various other considerations in the way in which the bill was passed. And on the other hand, a response to the ruling may not be made until the end of May, the end of this month, in part because to do so, Republicans, specifically the state's attorney general, among others, would have to give up a certain degree of immunity and themselves face some legal difficulties. So both sides are sort of geared up around current and ongoing legal processes which are beyond the ken of the ordinary Wisconsinite, myself definitely included.
Well, Paul Buell, you're generally considered one of the fine historians of the American left. I remember meeting you and I contributed an article to the Encyclopedia of the American Left that you edited 20 years ago. You understand strategy and tactics. And what's your take on trying to recall these Republican senators and some of the Democrats? Is that enough?
Well,
what is that going to do?
There's a dilemma. The dilemma is that some leaders of the Democratic Party were never happy with the mass demonstrations and eager to see them end, and determined that once the 14 Democrats came back, that all of the demonstrations would end. They did not like these particular Democrats, did not like the occupation of the Capitol, tried to deceive people into leaving the Capitol so it could be cleared out and good spirit brought back between Republicans and Democrats, until the next election when the Democrats would be elected. The effort to drown out public demonstrations with appeals for elections didn't happen, but remains a certain kind of threat. Meanwhile, the recall efforts are widely attended to. Events around them are significant and go on at the same time as confrontations with these various legislators and the governor in many places in the state whenever they make a public appearance. Those crowds that show up locally are just as important as the signatures for the recall. But these things go along together, and meanwhile, the marching season has come with good weather in Madison and elsewhere. And the demonstrations in Milwaukee this last Sunday, I suppose, are mirrored by a fish-in of anti-Walker progressives in Chippewa Falls the same day in the distant north.
Chippewa Falls.
But can you give us, you know, an idea, Paul? When we were chatting, you mentioned the demonstration in Milwaukee.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, Arden papers didn't even, I didn't see any of it until you mentioned it.
Yep.
And you said it was something like 100,000 people. So tell us what that means, what's its significance. That seems extraordinary to me. I mean, it's not like Milwaukee is a huge city. I mean, it's
600,000.
Since the first of the immigrant rights marches in 2006, I believe, which occasioned a large turnout in Madison around the Capitol, there has been a bringing together of the historic May Day events along with immigrant rights events, logically speaking, the new May Day. What was done in Milwaukee, I happened to be in a different program in Madison at the time, but what was done in Milwaukee was to appeal for immigrant rights, because there are a great number of Latinos, especially Mexican-Americans, a relatively recent population growth in Milwaukee, with the traditional labor forces, which despite the shutdown of so many factories, still retain a real warmth of support in Milwaukee, as they do across the state. Even when the jobs are gone, people who are the children and grandchildren of union members and of firefighters and others still around today have very, very strong feelings about this effort to deal a death blow to the labor tradition and the larger progressive tradition in Wisconsin.
Paul, have you looked at all beyond the borders of Wisconsin? I mean, Illinois, Ohio have laws that are as nasty, if possibly nastier, than the ones they're looking at in Wisconsin, and how the movement in Wisconsin might have affected those states?
Yeah, I don't think so much in Illinois, but most emphatically in Ohio and Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Maine. And the question is has been whether it's possible in those places for there to be actual mass demonstrations and occupations. And it seems to me as if direct action and occupations with perfect social peace, so that the elderly and the young parents with babes in arms feel comfortable being on the scene, whether those things happen. There has been an occupation, I know, of the Capitol in Washington State. I'm not really clear about a number of other places. I was told the contrast with Indiana is that people who are unionists were bussed in from Gary, or that part of the state, to the capital of Indiana and read the Pledge of Allegiance and given a couple hours of labor speeches and then bussed back home. That's probably as severe a contrast as one could imagine. The great advantage of Wisconsin is that Madison is also the center of historic social movements, and thousands of people with gray hair or no hair, my age that is, who were part of the demonstrations of the 1960s and early 70s, and have been eager for something like this to happen.
Tell us about the structure of the movement in Madison. Who's participating? Who goes to the meetings? What do you do? What's been your role? If Michael and Heidi and I were there, what would we be able to do?
These are extremely good questions, and they have sort of changed week to week. It appeared to the superficial observer as if everything happened in a spontaneous fashion. Of course, this is never so. There are always people on the ground. But that isn't to say that the forces that were organizing had any idea of the massiveness of the response to their organizing. That's the thing that was extraordinary and unexpected. The unions that were most affected did some of the serious organizing, but there's a wonderful and accurate anecdote that on the Monday that began the large demonstration, it was a couple of high school students in famously Norwegian-American Stoughton, Wisconsin, some miles from Madison, who through Facebook organized the rest of the students to leave the school. The next day, teachers in Dane County took the day off, and the following day, teachers across the state did. And by the end of the week, there were large demonstrations in Madison, supported strongly by NEA affiliated teachers unions, AFP, which was many of the social workers, AFSCME, which was a great number of city workers, and led symbolically in a way a bit actually by the firefighters and off-duty police, who were exempted from the worst parts of the new bill, but determined to support it in the spirit of the social state. It was incumbent upon the rest of us, we the many thousand, to show up every day and for quite some time to show up twice a day, marching around the Capitol and or sitting in the Capitol, inside the Capitol overnight, and to tell our friends and relatives to get themselves to these demonstrations. But also one more important thing, to devise really, really funny signs to bring to the demonstration.
That's one of your specialties.
the ones that were not humorous were also extremely telling. An early one was read, "Scott Walker, who will wipe your ass when you have a stroke?" Held up by a nurse, naturally. Or as related to the historic business traveler from Chicago, up for a fun weekend with sex workers, "Scotty, the money is on the dresser." A phrase that I hadn't even known was part of Wisconsin lore, but you know, that's it. That's it in resort towns. The money's on the dresser, and lots of other "Scott Walker, you didn't even buy me dinner before you tried to screw me," as held up by a middle-aged lady. And so many other handmade signs or copy shop signs that were absolutely terrific and went along with oom-pah-pah bands people singing the Wisconsin Loyalty Song, firemen in their kilts playing bagpipes, and so on and so on and so forth. The extraordinary pageantry and homemade pageantry of the whole thing inspired everybody to pitch in at some level or other. Well, most of us didn't have much to do or much knowledge, extreme knowledge, of the organizing that went on within the unions that I mentioned, but also, very importantly, the Teaching Assistance Association, of which I was a founding member during the strike that won the contract in 1970, but which had the crucial role of organizing people and organizing the peace, making sure that the police would step back when the Capitol was occupied, but also making sure that people cleaned up everything or during the extended occupation of the Capitol, so that there was a quiet space for infants on the first down in the basement, so that there were changing rooms, so that there were a little mini library for left-wing insomniacs, so that people took down the signs that they should be taken down, and so on and so on and so forth, an apparatus that was created overnight, so to speak, but which maintained the sense of safety and good geniality among all who were there, despite the numbers and the excitement and the music and so on.
Weren't you glad you lived long enough to see it? Just extraordinary.
That was the phrase that went through my mind repeatedly.
Yeah, well, where do we go from here in Wisconsin? And more broadly, what's your take on where the country generally is going?
Boy, where do we go from here in Wisconsin? Well, there's a deep ambiguity here. On the one hand, the Republicans have to be smashed. And on the other hand, an uncertainty about what the Democrats have in mind. And likewise, a sense that it would be remarkable in a nearly divided state between Republican and Democrats, in which Obama won the last presidential election because so many Republicans were disgusted with Bush and didn't vote. Can Obama, with a very, very unpopular war record for traditionally isolationist peacenik Wisconsin, can he possibly be reelected unless a whole lot of troops are pulled out of Afghanistan? That's quite a ponder, and we don't yet know the answer. The Obama signs all went down from the yards a long time ago and aren't coming back up. So there's an ambivalence here, and in my view, I'm not the only one, the ambivalence is reflected nationally. The labor movement seems clueless in terms of national labor leadership in making the most of this situation, other than issuing dictums from Washington and leaders showing up at various demonstrations. They don't seem to have any tactical or strategic sense of how to use this energy. And that's a real significant problem. On the other hand, being as hopeful as possible, there has been generated a very great dynamic and sense of possibly successful pushback. I have the feeling that that's going to find many different forms and may generate creativity as well as the mobilizing strength to make a real difference.
Well, Paul Buell, it's been very interesting hearing your report from Madison.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio.
Hello,
on
everybody.
Facebook.
I want to tell you about a little dream I had this morning. I had a dream that I went down this beautiful corridor, and there was a cot, and there was someone sleeping in the cot. And I went, and there sleeping under a beautiful piece of white muslin was Gandhi. And I stood over him and watched him sleep. And next to him there was a water glass, and it was empty. So I put some distilled water in it and watched him sleep for a while, and then I woke up. And what I took that as, I took it as a good sign. I took it to remember one important thing, the most important thing, that the people can accomplish anything, but how do the people accomplish it? Through their numbers. Gandhi proved that the people could accomplish anything through their numbers. Now, we have seen in the media, which teaches us nothing, that 96% are behind the president's foreign policy. I guess we're the 4% that isn't. Let's make that 4% grow and grow and grow. People, we must unite. These little gatherings are the beginning. We must unite, and we must get strong. We must be clean. And if you're worried about all of the things that they're trying to make you scared about, whether it's germs or anything, you want to do something for yourself, take care of yourself. Build your immune system. Be strong. Don't be afraid. And don't be led by the media. We the people are supposed to dictate foreign policy. Right now, our government is keeping us out of foreign policy. That is a direct infringement of our rights. Don't just sit around and let them think for us. Be strong. Be strong. Be aware. Wake up. We have the power. I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear. And the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken to the cry. Come on.
Hold on.
People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Where there were deserts, I saw fountains, and like cream, the waters rise. And we strolled there together, when none to laugh or criticize. And the leopard and the lamb lay together, truly bound. Well, I was hoping, in my hoping, to recall what I had found. I was dreaming, my dreaming, God knows a pure view. As I surrender into my sleeping, I commit my dream to you. Come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. The power to dream, to rule, the world from fools. It's decreed that people rule. It's decreed that people rule. Listen, I believe everything we dream can come to pass. And when you break one acoustic guitar string, it's good luck. We broke two. Be positive.